Penguin Random House Audio presents The Judge's List by John Grisham. Read for you by Mary Louise Parker, with an introduction read by the author.
Hi, I'm John Grisham, and welcome to the audio edition of my latest novel, The Judge's List. I'm not calling it a sequel because sequels usually deal with a continuation of a previous story. Rather, it is another adventure in the life and career of one of my favorite characters, Lacey Stultz. You met Lacey a few years back in a book called The Whistler. At that time, she was a 35-year-old lawyer, single, attractive, pretty cool, and hip. In fact, I've always had a crush on Lacey. In The Whistler, she was working for the Florida Board on Judicial Conduct. Her job was to investigate complaints involving allegations of misconduct by judges in Florida. In one of her investigations, she uncovered a breathtaking scheme of corruption by a crime syndicate with massive payoffs to an elected sitting judge. Lacey put the criminals away, but not before they almost killed her. Since then, I've wanted to bring her back, but I could not create a story as big and sensational as The Whistler. Until now. In The Judge's List, Lacey is confronted by a mysterious woman who claims that a circuit court judge in Pensacola is responsible for a long-running series of murders, a serial killer, who also happens to wear a black robe. The woman knows her stuff because, as she claims, the judge murdered her father 20 years earlier, and she has been on the killer's trail ever since. Lacey has never dealt with such a serious allegation. In fact, after some initial research, she realizes that in the history of American law, a sitting judge has never been accused of murder. That is about to change. At first, Lacey is reluctant to get involved. Her job does not include investigating violent crimes. That's for the state police and the FBI, professionals who carry guns. But her job requires her to open a file and start asking questions. Before long, she realizes that to survive, it is imperative that she keep her name off the judge's list. Enjoy the book.
1. The call came through the office landline, through a system that was at least 20 years old and had fought off all technological advances. It was taken by a tattooed receptionist named Felicity, a new girl who would be gone before she fully understood the phones. They were all leaving, it seemed, especially the clerical help. Turnover was ridiculous. Morale was low. The Board on Judicial Conduct had just seen its budget chopped for the fourth straight year by a legislature that hardly knew it existed. Felicity managed to route the call down the hall to the cluttered desk of Lacey Stultz. "There's a call on line 3, she announced. "Who is it?" Lacey asked. She wouldn't say. There were so many ways to respond. At that moment, though, Lacey was bored, and she did not wish to waste the emotional energy necessary to properly chastise the kid and set her straight. Routines and protocols were crumbling. Office discipline was waning as BJC spiraled into a leaderless mess. As a veteran, the veteran, it was important to set an example. "Thanks," she said, and punched the blinking light. "Lacey Stultz." "Good afternoon, Miss Stultz. Do you have a moment?" Female, educated, no hint of an accent, mid-40s, give or take 3 years. Lacey always played the voice game. "And to whom do I have the pleasure?" "My name is Margie for now, but I use other ones." Lacey was amused and almost chuckled. "Well, at least you're upfront about it. It normally takes me some time to work through the aliases. Anonymous callers were routine. People with gripes about judges were always cautious and hesitant to come forward and take on the system. Almost all feared retaliation from the powers on high. Margie said, "I'd like to talk to you, somewhere private." "My office is private, if you'd like." "Oh, no," she snapped, apparently frightened at the thought. "That won't work. You know the Siler building next door?" "Of course," Lacey said as she stood and looked out her window at the Siler building, one of several nondescript government addresses in downtown Tallahassee. Margie said, "There's a coffee bar on the ground floor. Can we meet there?" "I suppose. When?" "Now. I'm on my second latte." "Slow down. Give me a few minutes. And you'll recognize me?" "Yes, you're on the website. I'm in the rear, left side." Lacey's office was indeed private. The one to her left was empty, vacated by an ex-colleague who'd moved on to a bigger agency. Across the hall, an office had been converted into a makeshift storage closet. She walked toward Felicity and ducked into the office of Darren Trope, a 2-year man already prowling for another job. "You busy?" she asked as she interrupted whatever he was doing. "Not really." It didn't matter what he was or was not doing. If Lacey needed anything, Darren belonged to her. "Need a favor. I'm stepping over to Siler to meet a stranger who just admitted that she is using a fake name." "Oh, I love the cloak and dagger. Sure beats sitting here reading about some judge who made lewd comments to a witness." "How lewd?" "Pretty graphic." "Any photos? Videos?" "Not yet." "Let me know if you get them. So, mind stepping over in 15 minutes and taking a picture?" "Sure, no problem. No idea who she is?" "None whatsoever." Lacey left the building, took her time walking around the block, enjoyed a moment of cool air, and strolled into the lobby of the Siler building. It was almost 4 p.m., and there were no other customers drinking coffee at that hour. Margie was at a small table in the rear to the left. She waved quickly as though someone might notice and she didn't want to get caught. Lacey smiled and walked toward her. African-American, mid-40s, professional, attractive, educated, slacks and heels, and dressed nicer than Lacey, though around BJC these days, any and all attire was allowed. The old boss wanted coats and ties and hated jeans, but he had retired 2 years ago and took most of the rules with him. Lacey passed the counter where the barista was loafing with both elbows stuck on the formica, hands cradling her pink phone that had her thoroughly fascinated. She did not look up, never thought about greeting a customer, and Lacey decided to pass on more caffeine anyway. Without standing, Margie stuck out a hand and said, "Nice to meet you. Would you like some coffee?" Lacey smiled, shook her hand, and sat across the square table. "No thanks. And it's Margie, right?" "For now." "Okay, we're off to a bad start. Why are you using an alias?" "My story will take hours to tell, and I'm not sure you want to hear it." "Then why bother?" "Please, Ms. Stoltz." "Lacey." "Please, Lacey. You have no idea the emotional trauma I've been through trying to get to this point in my life. I'm a wreck right now, okay?" She seemed fine, though a bit on edge. Perhaps it was the second latte. Her eyes darted right and left. They were pretty and surrounded by large purple frames. The lenses were probably not needed. The glasses were part of the outfit, a subtle disguise. Lacey said, "I'm not sure what to say. Why don't you start talking and maybe we'll get somewhere?" "I've read about you." She reached down into a backpack and deftly pulled out a file. The Indian casino case, not long ago? You caught a judge skimming and put her away. One reporter described it as the largest bribery scandal in the history of American jurisprudence. The file was 2 inches thick and gave every impression of being immaculately organized. Lacey noted the use of the word jurisprudence, odd for a layperson. It was a big case, she said, feigning modesty. Margie smiled and said, Big? You broke up a crime syndicate, nailed the judge, and sent a bunch of people to prison. All are still there, I believe. True, but it was far from a one-girl takedown. The FBI was heavily involved. It was a complicated case, and some people were killed, including your colleague, Mr. Hugo Hatch. Yes, including Hugo. Curious, why all of this research about me? Margie folded her hands and rested them on top of the file, which she had not opened. Her index fingers were shaking slightly. She looked at the entrance and glanced around again. Though no one had entered, no one had left, no one had moved, not even the barista who was lost in the clouds. She took a sip from her straw. If it really was her second latte, it had barely been touched. She had used the word trauma, admitted to being a wreck. Lacey realized the woman was frightened. Margie said, Oh, I'm not sure it's research, just some stuff off the internet. Everything's out there, you know? Lacey smiled and tried to be patient. I'm not sure we're getting anywhere. Your job is to investigate judges who were accused of wrongdoing, right? That's correct. And you've been doing it for how long? I'm sorry, why is this relevant? Please. 12 years. Giving that number was like admitting defeat. It sounded so long. How do you get involved in a case? Margie asked, bouncing around. Lacey took a deep breath and reminded herself to be patient. People with complaints who got this far were often rattled. She smiled and said, Well, typically a person with a complaint against a judge will contact us and we'll have a meeting. If the gripe appears to have some merit, then the person will file a formal complaint, which we keep locked up for 45 days while we take a look. We call it an assessment. 9 times out of 10, that's as far as it gets, and the complaint is dismissed. If we find possible wrongdoing, then we notify the judge and he or she has 30 days to respond. Usually, everybody lawyers up. We investigate, have hearings, bring in witnesses, the works. As she spoke, Darren strolled in alone, disturbed the barista by ordering decaf, waited on it while ignoring the two women, then took it to a table on the other side of the room where he opened a laptop and began what appeared to be some serious work. Without giving the slightest hint, he aimed the laptop's camera at Lacey's back and Margie's face, zoomed in for a close shot, and began filming. He took a video and some still shots. If Margie noticed him, it was not apparent. She listened intently to Lacey and asked, How often is a judge removed from office? Again, why is this relevant? Not very often, fortunately. We have jurisdiction over 1,000 judges, and the vast majority are honest, hardworking professionals. Most of the complaints we see are just not that serious. Disgruntled litigants who didn't get what they wanted, a lot of divorce cases, a lot of lawyers mad because they lost. We stay busy, but for the most part, the conflicts are resolved. She made the job sound boring, and after 12 years, it rather felt that way. Margie listened carefully, her fingertips tapping the file. She took a deep breath and asked, The person who files the complaint, Is he or she always identified? Lacey thought for a second and said, Eventually, yes. It's quite rare for the complaining party to remain anonymous. Why? Because the complainant usually knows the facts of the case and needs to testify against the judge. It's hard to nail a judge when the people he ticked off are afraid to come forward. Are you afraid? The very word seemed to frighten her. Yes, you could say that, she admitted. Lacey frowned and appeared bored. Look, let's cut to the chase here. How serious is the behavior that you're talking about? Margie closed her eyes and managed to say, Murder? She immediately opened them and glanced around to see if anyone had overheard. There was no one close enough to hear anything except Lacey, who absorbed this with the hard-boiled skepticism she had developed after so many years on the job. She reminded herself again to be patient. When she looked at Margie's eyes again, they were wet. Lacey leaned in a bit closer and softly asked, Are you suggesting that one of our sitting judges has committed a murder? Margie bit her lip and shook her head. I know he has. May I ask how you know this? My father was one of his victims. Lacey inhaled this and glanced around herself. Victims? As in more than one? Yes. I believe my father was his second victim. I'm not sure which number, but I'm certain of his guilt. Interesting. That's an understatement. How many complaints have you had about judges killing people? Well, none. Exactly. In the history of America, how many judges have been convicted of murder while on the bench? I've never heard of one. Exactly, zero. So don't dismiss this as something interesting. Didn't mean to offend. Across the way, Darren finished his important business and left. Neither woman acknowledged his departure. Margie said, No offense taken. I'm not going any further in this coffee bar. I have a lot of information that I would like to share with you and no one else, but not here. Lacey had encountered her share of nuts and unbalanced souls with boxes and paper sacks filled with documents that clearly proved that some sleazeball up on the bench was thoroughly corrupt. Almost always, after a few minutes of face-to-face interaction, she could reach her verdict and begin making plans to route the complaint to the dismissal drawer. Over the years, she had learned to read people, though with many of the wackos that came her way, a quick evaluation wasn't much of a challenge. Margie, or whoever, was neither a nut, nor a wacko, nor an unbalanced soul. She was on to something, and she was frightened. Lacey said, Okay, where do we go next? What is next? Look, you contacted me. Do you want to talk or not? I don't play games, and I don't have time to pry information out of you or any other person who wants to complain about a judge. I waste a lot of time cajoling information out of people who call me in the first place. I go down a dead-end trail once a month. Are you talking or not? Margie was crying again and wiping her cheeks. Lacey studied her with as much compassion as possible, but she was also willing to leave the table and never come back. However, she was intrigued by the idea of murder. Part of her daily grind around BJC was suffering through the mundane and frivolous gripes of unhappy people with small problems and little to lose. A murder by a sitting judge seemed too sensational to believe. Finally, Margie said, I have a room at the Ramada on East Gaines. We could meet there after hours, but you have to come alone. Lacey nodded as if she'd anticipated this. With precautions, We have a rule that prohibits me from conducting an initial meeting with a complaining party off-premises and alone. I would have to bring another investigator, one of my colleagues. Like Mr. Trope over there? Margie asked, nodding at Darren's empty chair. Lacey slowly turned around to see what in the world she was talking about as she tried desperately to think of a response. Margie continued, "It's your website, okay?" Smiling faces of all staff. From her briefcase, she removed an 8x10 color photo of herself and slid it across the table. "Here, with best wishes, a current color mug of myself that's far better than the ones Mr. Trope just stole." "What are you talking about?" "I'm sure he's already run my pic through your facial recognition software and he's found nothing. I'm in nobody's data bank." "What are you talking about?" Margie was dead on, but Lacey was rattled and not ready to come clean. "Oh, I think you know. You'll come alone, or you'll never see me again. You're the most experienced investigator in your office, and at this moment, your boss is only a temp. You can probably do whatever you want."
"I wish it were that easy."
"Let's call it an after-work drink, that's all. We'll meet in the bar, and if it goes well, we can go upstairs to my room and talk with even more privacy."
"I cannot go to your room. It's against our procedures. If a complaint is filed and it becomes necessary to meet in private, then I can do so. Someone has to know where I am, at least initially."
"Fair enough. What time?"
"How about 6?
I'll be in the back corner, right-hand side, and I'll be alone. Same as you. No wires, recorders, secret cameras, no colleagues pretending to drink as they film away. And say hello to Darren. Maybe one day I'll have the pleasure. Deal?"
"Deal.
Okay, you can go now." As Lacey walked around the block and drifted back to her office, she had to admit that she could not remember ever getting her butt so thoroughly kicked at the first interview. She slid the color photo across Darren's desk and said, "Nice work. Busted. Big time. She knows our names, ranks, and serial numbers. She gave me this photo and said it was far better than the ones you were taking with your laptop." Darren held the photo and said, "Well, she's right." "Any idea who she is?"
"Nope.
I've run her face through our laundry and got nothing, which, as you know, means little." "Means she has not been arrested in Florida in the past 6 years. Can you punch it through the FBI?"
"Probably not. They require a reason, and since I know nothing, I can't give them one."
"Can I ask an obvious question?"
"Please do."
"BJC is an investigative agency, right?"
"Supposed to be."
"Then why do we post our photos and bios on a rather stupid website?"
"Ask the boss."
"We don't have a boss. We have a career paper pusher who'll be gone before we miss her."
"Probably."
"Look, Darren, we've had this conversation a dozen times. We don't want our lovely faces on any BJC page. That's why I haven't updated mine in 5 years. I still look 34.
"I'd say 31, but then I'm biased."
"Thank you. I guess there's no real harm. It's not like we're going after murderers and drug dealers."
"Right. So what's her complaint, whoever she is?"
"Don't know yet. Thanks for the backup."
"A lot of good it did."
2. The Ramada Lounge covered one large corner of the hotel's soaring glass atrium. By 6, its chrome bar was crowded with well-dressed lobbyists trolling for attractive secretaries from the agencies, and most of the tables were taken. The Florida legislature was in session 5 blocks away at the Capitol, and all the downtown lounges were busy with important people talking politics and angling for money and sex. Lacey entered, got her share of looks from the male crowd, and walked toward the right rear, where she found Margie alone at a small table in a corner with a glass of water in front of her.
"Thanks for coming," she said as Lacey took a seat.
"Sure. You know this place?"
"No, first time. Pretty popular, huh?"
"This time of the year, yes. Things settle down when the carnival is over."
"The carnival?"
"The legislative session. January through March. Lock the liquor cabinet, hide the women and children. You know the routine."
"I'm sorry."
"I take it you don't live here."
"No, I don't."
A harried waitress rushed to a stop and asked if they wanted something to drink as she frowned at the glass of water. Her message was pretty clear. "Hey, gals, we're busy, and I can give your table to somebody who'll pay for booze."
"A glass of Pinot Grigio," Lacey said.
"Same,"
Margie quickly agreed, and the waitress was gone.
Lacey glanced right and left to make sure whatever they said could not be overheard. It could not. The tables were spaced far enough apart, and a steady roar emanated from the bar and drowned out everything else. Lacey said, "Okay, so you don't live here, and I don't know your real name. I'd say we're off to a slow start, which I'm accustomed to. However, as I think I told you, I waste a lot of time with people who contact me, then clam up when it's time to tell their stories.
What would you like to know first?"
"How about your name?"
"I can do that."
"Great. But I'd like to know what you'll do with my name. Do you open a file? Is it a digital file or an old-fashioned pen on paper file? If it's digital, where is it stored? Who else will know my name?"
Lacey swallowed hard and steadied her eyes. Margie could not hold the stare and glanced away. Lacey asked, "You're nervous and act as though you're being followed?"
"I'm not being followed, Lacey, but everything leaves a trail."
"A trail for someone else to follow.
Is this someone the judge you suspect of murder? Help me here, Margie. Give me something."
"Everything leaves a trail. You've said that."
The waitress hustled by, pausing just long enough to set down two glasses of wine and a bowl of nuts. Margie appeared not to notice the wine, but Lacey took a sip. She said, "So we're still stuck on the name thing. I'll write it down somewhere and keep it off our network initially." Margie nodded and became someone else.
"Jerry Crosby, age 46. Professor of political science at the University of South Alabama in Mobile. One marriage, one divorce, one child, a daughter."
"Thank you."
"And you believe your father was murdered by a judge who's now on the bench, correct?"
"Yes,
a Florida judge."
"That narrows it down to about 1,000.
A circuit judge in the 22nd district."
"Impressive. Now we're down to about 40. When do I get the name of your suspect?"
"Real soon. Can we slow down a bit? Right now, it doesn't take much to rattle me."
"You haven't touched your wine. It might help."
Jerry took a sip and a deep breath and said, "I'm guessing you're around 40 years old?"
"Almost. 39, so I'll turn 40 soon enough."
"Traumatic?"
"Well, sort of, I guess, but life goes on. So, 22 years ago, you were still in high school, right?"
"I suppose.
Why is this relevant?"
"Relax, Lacey. I'm talking now, okay? We're getting somewhere.
You were just a kid, and you probably never read about the murder of Brian Burke, a retired professor of law."
"Never heard of it."
"Your father?"
"Yes."
"I'm sorry."
"Thanks." For almost 30 years, my father taught at Stetson Law School in Gulfport, Florida, in the Tampa area. I'm familiar with the school. He retired at the age of 60 for family reasons and returned to his hometown in South Carolina. I have a thorough file on my father, which I'll give you at some point. He was quite a man. Needless to say, his murder rocked our world, and frankly, I'm still reeling. Losing a parent too young is bad enough, but when it's murder, and an unsolved murder, it's even more devastating. 22 years later, the case is even colder, and the police have all but given up. Once we realized that they were getting nowhere, I vowed to try everything to find his killer. The police gave up. She drank some wine. Over time, yes, the file is still open, and I talk to them occasionally. I'm not knocking the cops, you understand. They did the best they could under the circumstances, but it was a perfect murder. All of them are. Lacey drank some wine. A perfect murder? Yes. No witnesses. No forensics, at least none that can be traced to the killer. No apparent motive. Lacey almost asked, and so what am I supposed to do? But she took another sip and said, I'm not sure the Board on Judicial Conduct is equipped to investigate an old murder case in South Carolina. I'm not asking for that. Your jurisdiction is over Florida judges who might be involved in wrongdoing, right? Right? And that includes murder? I suppose, but we've never been involved in that. That's heavier work for the state boys, maybe the FBI. The state boys have tried. The FBI has no interest for two reasons. First, there is no federal issue. Second, there is no evidence linking the murders. Thus, the FBI doesn't know, no one knows but me, I guess, that we're dealing with a potential serial killer. You've contacted the FBI? Years ago, as the family of the victim, we were desperate for help. Got nowhere. Lacey drank some more wine. Okay. You're making me nervous, so let's walk through this real slow. You believe a sitting judge murdered your father 22 years ago. Was that judge on the bench when the murder occurred? No. He was elected in 2004. Lacey absorbed this and looked around. What appeared to be a lobbyist was now sitting at the next table, gawking at her with a sort of leering vulgarity that was not uncommon around the Capitol. She glared at him until he looked away, then leaned in closer. I'd feel more comfortable if we could talk somewhere else. This place is getting crowded. Jerry said, I have a small conference room on the first floor. I promise it's safe and secure. If I try to assault you, you can scream and get away. I'm sure it's okay. Jerry paid for the wine, and they left the bar in the atrium and rode the escalator up one flight to the business mezzanine where Jerry unlocked a small conference room, one of many. On the table were several files. The women settled on opposite sides of the table. The files within reaching distance, and nothing in front of them. No laptops, no legal pads. Both cell phones were still in their purses. Jerry was visibly more relaxed than in the bar and began with, So, let's talk off the record, with no notes. None for now, anyway. My father, Brian Burke, retired from Stetson in 1990. He taught there for almost 30 years and was a legend, a beloved professor. He and my mother decided to return home to Gaffney, South Carolina, the small town where they grew up. They had lots of family in the area, and there's some land that had been handed down. They built this beautiful little cottage in the woods and planted a garden. My mother's mother lived on the property, and they took care of her. All in all, it was a pleasant retirement. They were set financially, in pretty good health, active in a country church. Dad read a lot, wrote articles for legal magazines, kept up with old friends, made some new ones around town. Then he was murdered. She reached to retrieve a file, a blue one, letter size, about an inch thick, same as the others. She slid it across the table as she said, "This is a collection of articles about my father, his career, and his death. Some dug up by hand, some pulled from the internet, but none of the file is stored online." Lacey didn't open the file. Jerry continued, "Behind the yellow tab, there is a crime scene photo of my father. I've seen it several times and prefer not to see it again. Have a look." Lacey opened to the tab and frowned at the enlarged color photo. The deceased was lying in some weeds with a small rope around his neck, pulled tightly and cutting into his skin. The rope appeared to be nylon, blue in color, and stained with dried blood. At the back of the neck, it was secured with a thick knot. Lacey closed the file and whispered, "I'm so sorry." It's weird. After 22 years, you learn to deal with the pain and place it in a box where it tends to stay if you work hard enough. But it's always easy to drop your guard and allow the memories to come back. Right now, I'm okay, Lacey. Right now, I'm real good because I'm talking to you and doing something about it. You have no idea how many hours I've spent pushing myself to get here. This is so hard, so terrifying. Perhaps if we talked about the crime. She took a deep breath. Sure. Dad liked to take long walks through the woods behind his cottage. Mom often went along, but she struggled with arthritis. One lovely spring morning in 1992, he kissed her goodbye, grabbed his walking stick, and headed down the trail. The autopsy revealed death by asphyxiation, but there was also a head wound. It wasn't hard to speculate that he encountered someone who hit him in the head, knocked him out, then finished him off with the nylon rope. He was dragged off the trail and left in a ravine where they found him late in the afternoon. The crime scene revealed nothing. No blunt instrument, no shoe or boot prints. The ground was dry. No signs of a struggle, no stray hairs or fabrics left behind, nothing. The rope has been analyzed by crime labs and gives no clue. There's a description of it in the file. The cottage isn't far from town, but it's still somewhat isolated, and there were no witnesses, nothing out of the ordinary, no car or truck with out-of-state tags, no strangers lurking around. There are many different places to park and hide and sneak into the area, then leave without a trace. Nothing has come to the surface in 22 years, Lacey. It's a very cold case. We have accepted the harsh reality that the crime will never be solved. We? Yes. Well, it's more like a one cowboy rodeo. My mother died 2 years after my father. She never recovered and kind of went off the deep end. I have an older brother in California, and he hung in for a few years before losing interest. He got tired of the police reporting no progress. We talk occasionally, but rarely mention Dad, so I'm on my own. It's lonely out here. Sounds awful. It also seems a long way from the crime scene in South Carolina to a courthouse in the Florida Panhandle. What's the connection? There's not much, honestly. Just a lot of speculation. You haven't come this far with nothing but speculation. What about motive? Motive is all I have. Do you plan to share it with me? Hang on, Lacey. You have no idea. I can't believe I'm sitting here accusing someone of murder without proof. You're not accusing anyone, Jerry. You have a potential suspect, otherwise you wouldn't be here. You tell me his name, and I tell no one. Not until you authorize it, okay? Understood? Yes. Now,
Back to motive. Motive has consumed me since the beginning. I found no one in my father's world who disliked him. He was an academic, drew a nice salary, and saved his money. He never invested in deals or land or anything like that. In fact, he was disdainful of developers and speculators. He had a couple of colleagues, other law professors who lost money in the stock market, condos, and other schemes, and he had little sympathy for them. He had no business interests, no partners, no joint ventures, stuff that generally creates conflict and enemies. He hated debt and paid his bills on time. He was faithful to his wife and family, as far as we knew. If you knew Brian Burke, you would have found it impossible to believe that he would be unfaithful to his wife. He was treated fairly by his employers, Stetson, and admired by his students. 4 times in 30 years at Stetson, he was voted outstanding professor of law. He routinely passed up a promotion to the dean's office because he considered teaching the highest calling, and he wanted to be in the classroom. He wasn't perfect, Lacey, but he was pretty damn close to it. I wish I had known him. He was a charming, sweet man with no known enemies. It wasn't a robbery, because his wallet was in the house and nothing was missing from his body. It certainly wasn't an accident. So the police have been baffled from the beginning. But, there could be more. It's a long shot, but it's all I have. I'm thirsty. You? Lacey shook her head. Jerry walked to her credenza, poured ice water from a pitcher, and returned to her seat. She took a deep breath and continued. As I've said, my father loved the classroom. He loved to lecture. To him, it was a performance, and he was the only actor on stage. He loved being in full command of his surroundings, his material, and especially his students. There's a room on the second floor of the law school that was his domain for decades. There's a plaque there now, and it's named for him. It's a mini lecture hall with 80 seats and a half moon, and every performance was sold out. His lectures on constitutional law were captivating, challenging, often funny. He had a great sense of humor. Every student wanted Professor Burke. He hated being called Dr. Burke, for constitutional law, and those who didn't make the cut often audited the class and sat through his lectures. It was not unusual for visiting professors, deans, alumni, and former students to squeeze in for a seat, often in folding chairs in the rear or down the aisles. The president of the university, himself a lawyer, was a frequent visitor. You get the picture? I do, and I can't imagine it. I can recall with horror my con law course. That seems to be the norm. The 80 students, all first year, who were lucky enough to get in, knew that he could be tough. He expected them to be prepared and ready to express themselves. Her eyes moistened again as she remembered her father. Lacey smiled and nodded and tried to encourage her. Dad loved to lecture. And he also loved the Socratic method of teaching, where he would select a student at random and ask him or her to brief a case for the benefit of the class. If the student made a mistake or couldn't hold her ground, then the discussion often became contentious. Over the years, I've talked to many of his former students, and while all still express admiration, they still shudder at the thought of trying to argue con law with Professor Burke. He was feared, but in the end, greatly admired. And every former student was shocked by his murder. Who could possibly want to kill Professor Burke?
You've talked to former students?
Yes. Under the guise of collecting anecdotes about my father for a possible book. I've been doing this for years. The book will never be written, but it's a great way to initiate a conversation.
Just say you're working on a book and people start talking. I have at least 24 photographs sent by his former students. Dad at graduation. Dad drinking a beer at a student softball game.
Dad on the bench during moot court.
All little slices of college life. They loved him. I'm sure you have a file.
Of course.
Not here. But I'm happy to show it to you. Maybe later. We were talking about motive.
Yes. Well, many years ago, I was talking to a lawyer in Orlando who studied under my father,
and he told me an interesting story. There was a kid in his class who was rank and file, nothing special. My father called on him in class one day to discuss a case involving the Fourth Amendment, searches and seizures. The kid was prepared, but believed something contrary to what my father was saying, and so they had a pretty good row.
My father loved it when students became passionate and fought back, but this student made some comments that were a bit extreme and out of line, and he was somewhat cocky in the way he bantered with Professor Burke, who managed to wrap things up with a laugh. The next class, the student probably figured that he was off the hook for a while and came in unprepared. Dad called on him again. Trying to wing it was an unpardonable sin, and the student flamed out in a big way. 2 days later, Professor Burke called on the student for the third time. He was prepared and ready to fight. Back and forth they went as Dad slowly boxed him into a corner. It's not wise to argue with any professor who's taught the same material for years, but this guy was arrogant and sure of himself. The knockout punch was a one-liner that destroyed the student's position and brought down the house. He was humiliated and totally lost it. He cursed, flung a notebook, snatched his backpack, and stomped out of the classroom, the door almost shattering behind him.
With perfect timing, my father said. I'm not sure he's cut out for jury trials.
The classroom exploded with laughter so loud, the student could not have missed it. He dropped the class and began a counterattack. He complained to the dean and the president. He considered himself a laughingstock and eventually withdrew from the law school. He wrote letters to alumni, politicians, other professors, some really bizarre behavior. He wrote letters to my father. They were remarkably well written, but rambling and not really threatening. The last letter was sent from a private mental health facility near Fort Lauderdale and written in longhand on its stationery. In it, he claimed to be suffering from a nervous breakdown caused entirely by my father. She paused and took a drink of water. Lacey waited, then said, "That's it? Motive is a disgruntled law student?"
"Yes, but it's far more complicated than that."
"Let's hope so. What happened to him?"
"He got his head together and finished law school at Miami. Now he's a judge."
"Look, I know you're skeptical, and with good reason, but he's the only possible suspect in the world."
"Why is it more complicated?"
Jerry took a long look at the files at the end of the table. There were 5 of them, all an inch thick, each a different color. Lacey followed her gaze, finally caught her drift, and asked, "And those are 5 more victims of the same killer?"
"If I didn't think so, I wouldn't be here."
"I'm sure there is a connection." "There are 2. One is the method. All 6 were hit in the head and then asphyxiated with the identical type of nylon rope. Each ligature was grated into the skin of the neck and tied off by the same knot and left behind, sort of like a calling card. And all 6 had a bad history with our judge."
a bad history? He knew them well, and he stalked them for years. Lacey caught her breath, swallowed hard, and felt a clutching fear in her stomach. Her mouth was suddenly dry, but she managed to say, "Don't tell me his name. I'm not sure I'm ready for it." There was a long gap in the conversation as both women gazed at the walls. Lacey finally said, "Look, I've heard enough for one day. Let me stew on this, and I'll give you a call." Jerry smiled and nodded and was suddenly subdued. They swapped phone numbers and said their goodbyes. Lacey hurried through the lobby and couldn't wait to get in her car. 3. Her apartment was a chic, ultra-modern unit in a newly renovated warehouse not far from the Florida State campus. She lived alone, at least most of the time, with Frankie, her obnoxious French bulldog. The dog was always waiting at the door, turning flips to urinate in the flower beds, regardless of the hour. Lacey let him outside for a pee, then poured a glass of wine, fell onto the sofa, and stared out the large plate glass window. It was early March. The days were getting longer, but they were still too short. She had grown up in the Midwest and did not miss the cold, dark winters with too much snow and too little sunshine. She loved the Panhandle with its mild winters, real seasons, and long, warm spring days. In 2 weeks, the clock would change. The days would lengthen, and the college town would get even livelier with backyard cookouts, pool parties, rooftop cocktails, and outdoor dining. And that was for the adults. The students would live in the sun, head for the beach, and work on their tans. 6 murders. After 12 years of investigating judges, Lacey considered herself immune from shock. She was also calloused and jaded enough to have serious doubts about Jerry's story, much the same way she doubted every complaint that landed on her desk. But Jerry Crosby wasn't lying. Her theories might be wrong, her hunches off base, her fears unfounded, but she believed that her father was murdered by a sitting judge. Lacey had left their meeting at the Ramada with nothing. The one file she opened had been left on the table for Jerry to deal with. Curiosity settled in. She checked her phone and saw 2 missed calls from Ali Pacheco, her boyfriend. He was out of town and she would chat with him later. She fetched her laptop and began searching. The 22nd Judicial District encompassed 3 counties in the far northwest corner of the state. Among the 400,000 or so people who lived in the 22nd were 41 circuit judges elected by that same population. In her 12 years at BJC, Lacey could remember only 2 or 3 minor cases from the 22nd. Of the 41 judges, 15 had been elected in 2004, the year Jerry said her suspect took the bench. Of those 15, only 1 finished law school at the University of Miami. In less than 10 minutes, Lacey had the name of Ross Bannock. He was 49, a native of Pensacola, undergrad at the University of Florida, no mention of a wife or family. Scant bio on the Judicial District's website. His photo portrayed a rather handsome guy with dark eyes, strong chin, and lots of salt and pepper hair. Lacey found him quite attractive and wondered why he wasn't married. Maybe he was divorced. She dug some more without getting too deep and found little about Judge Bannock. Evidently, he had managed to avoid controversy during his 2.5 terms on the bench. She went to her BJC files and found no complaint filed against him. In Florida, lawyers were expected to submit an annual review of the judges they encountered, anonymously, of course. For the past 5 years, Bannock had received a stellar A-plus rating from the bar. The comments were glowing. Prompt, punctual, prepared, courteous, professional, witty, compassionate, bright, an intimidating intellect. Only 2 other judges in the 22nd received such high marks. She kept digging and finally found some dirt. It was a newspaper article from the Pensacola Ledger, dated April 18, 2000. A local lawyer, Ross Bannock, age 35, was seeking his first political office and trying to unseat an old judge in the 22nd. Controversy arose when one of Bannock's clients, a real estate developer, proposed a water park on some prime property near a Pensacola beach. The park was strongly opposed by seemingly everyone, and in the midst of the lawsuits and related brouhaha, it was revealed that lawyer Bannock owned a 10% stake in the venture. The facts were not that clear, but it was alleged that he tried to hide his involvement. His opponent seized the moment and ran ads that proved fatal. The election returns from a later edition of the paper showed a landslide defeat for Bannock. Though it was impossible to determine with such scant evidence, it looked as though he had done nothing wrong. Nonetheless, he was beaten badly by the incumbent. Lacey dug some more and found the election coverage from 2004. There was a photo of the old judge who appeared to be at least 90 and two stories about his declining health. Bannock ran a slick campaign and the controversy from 4 years earlier was apparently forgotten. He won his race by 1,000 votes. His opponent died 3 months later. Lacey realized she was hungry and pulled a leftover quiche out of the fridge. Allie had been gone for 3 nights and she had not been cooking. She poured more wine and sat at her kitchen table, pecking away. In 2008, Bannock was unopposed for re-election. Sitting circuit judges rarely faced serious opposition in Florida, or any other state for that matter, and he seemed to be set for a long career on the bench. Her phone pinged and she jumped. Lost in another world, she had even forgotten about the quiche. Caller unknown. "Got his name yet?" Jerry asked. Lacey smiled and replied, "It wasn't difficult. Miami Law, elected in 2004 on the 22nd, that narrowed it down to one." "Nice looking guy, huh?" "Yes. Why is he not married?" "Don't get any ideas. I wasn't. He has a problem with women, part of his long history." Lacey took a deep breath. "Okay. I don't suppose you've met him." "Oh no, wouldn't go near him. He has security cameras everywhere, his courtroom, office, home." "That's weird." "Weird doesn't touch it." "Are you in the car?"
"I'm driving to Pensacola, maybe on to Mobile. I don't suppose you could meet me tomorrow."
"Where?"
"Pensacola.
That's 3 hours from here."
"Tell me about it."
"And what would be the purpose of our meeting?"
"I have only one purpose in life, Lacey, and you know what it is."
"I have a busy day."
"They're all busy, aren't they?"
"Afraid so."
"Okay. Then please put me on the calendar and let me know when we can meet there."
"Sure. I'll take a look." There was a long gap in the conversation, so long that Lacey finally asked, "Are you there?"
"Yes, sorry. I tend to drift."
"Have you found much online?"
"Some. Several stories about his elections, all from the Ledger."
"How about the one from 2000 about the land deal? In bed with the crooked developer, the one that cost him the election?"
"Yes, I've read that one."
"I have all of them in a file whenever you want to take it."
"Okay, we'll see."
That reporter was a guy named Danny Cleveland, originally from up north somewhere. He spent about 6 years with the Ledger, then moved around some. The newspaper in Little Rock, Arkansas was his last stop.
"Last stop?"
"Yes, they found him in his apartment. Asphyxiation, same rope, same unusual knot. Sailors call it the double clove hitch. Pretty rare. Another unsolved mystery, another very cold case." Lacey struggled to respond and noticed that her left hand was shaking.
Are you still there? Jerry asked.
I think so. When was 2009? Not a trace of evidence left behind. Look, Lacey, we're talking too much on the phone. I prefer face to face. Let me know when we can meet again. She abruptly ended the call. Her romance with Ali Pacheco was now into its third year and, in her opinion, was stalling. He was 38 years old, and though he denied it, even in therapy, he was still scarred from a terrible first marriage 11 years earlier. It had lasted 4 miserable months and mercifully ended without a pregnancy. The biggest obstacle to a more serious arrangement was a fact that was becoming more and more obvious. Both enjoyed the freedom of living alone. Since high school, Lacey had not lived with a man in the house, and she wasn't keen on having one around. She'd loved her father, but remembered him as a domineering, chauvinistic sort who treated his wife like a maid. Her mother, always subservient, excused his behavior and whispered over and over, "It's just his generation." It was a lame excuse, and one Lacey vowed to never accept. Ali was indeed different. He was kind, thoughtful, funny, and for the most part, attentive to her. He was also an FBI special agent, who these days was spending most of his time in South Florida chasing narco traffickers. When things were slow, which was rare, he was assigned to counterterrorism. There was even talk of him being transferred. After 8 years as a special agent with no shortage of commendations, he was always on the block to be shipped out, at least in Lacey's opinion. He kept a toothbrush and a shaving kit in her spare bathroom, along with some sweats and casual stuff in a closet, enough to sleep over whenever he wanted. She, on the other hand, maintained a presence in his small apartment 15 minutes away. Pajamas, old sneakers, older jeans, a toothbrush, and some fashion magazines on the coffee table. Neither was the jealous type, but each had quietly marked their territory in the other's place. Lacey would have been shocked to learn that Ali slept around. He just wasn't the type. Nor was she. Their challenge, with his travel and their demanding schedules, was keeping each other satisfied. It was taking more and more effort, and that was because, as a close girlfriend said, "You're approaching middle age." Lacey had been appalled at that term, and for the next month, chased Ali from her condo to his apartment and back until both were exhausted and called time out. He checked in at 7:30 and they chatted for a moment. He was on surveillance, whatever that meant, and couldn't say much. She knew he was somewhere around Miami. They both said, "I love you," and rang off. As a seasoned agent whose career meant everything, Ali was the consummate professional, and as such, said little about his work to Lacey anyway. To those he hardly knew, he would not even give the name of his employer. If pressed, his standard reply was, "Security." He pronounced the word with such authority that further questions were cut off. His friends were other agents. There were times, though, maybe after a drink or two, that he lowered his guard a bit and talked in generic terms about his work. Was often dangerous, and he, like most agents, lived for the adrenaline rush. By comparison, her cases were the same mundane complaints about judges drinking too much, taking gifts from law firms, dragging their feet, showing partiality, and getting involved in local politics. 6 murders would certainly liven up her caseload. She sent an email to her boss with the message that she had decided to take a personal day tomorrow and would not be in the office. The handbook gave her 4 PDs a year with no questions asked. She rarely took one, and even had 3 left over from the previous year. Lacey called Jerry and made arrangements to meet at 1 o'clock the next day in Pensacola. 4. But for Frankie, her PD would have begun with sleeping in, something she could only dream of. The dog was making noises before sunrise and needed to go outside. Afterward, Lacey stretched out on the sofa and tried to nap, but Frankie decided it was time for breakfast. So Lacey sipped her coffee and watched the day slowly arrive. Her thoughts were a mix of excitement over the meeting with Jerry and the usual angst over her career. In 7 months, she would turn 40, a reality that saddened her. She was enjoying her life, but it was slipping by with no real plans to marry. She had never longed for children of her own and had already decided it wouldn't happen, and she was fine with that. All her friends had children, some even teenagers, and she was thankful she wasn't burdened with those challenges. She could not imagine finding the patience to raise kids in the age of cell phones, drugs, casual sex, social media, and everything else on the internet. She had joined BJC 12 years earlier. She should have left years ago, like virtually all the colleagues she had known. BJC was a nice place to begin a career, but a dead end for any serious lawyer. Her best friend from law school was a partner in a mega firm in Washington, but it was an all-consuming lifestyle that she wanted no part of. Their friendship required work, and Lacey often asked herself if it was worth it. Her other girlfriends from back then had drifted away, all scattered around the country, all consumed with busy lives at their desks and, when time allowed, at home with their families. Lacey wasn't sure where to look or what she wanted, so she had hung around BJC for too long and now worried that she'd missed better opportunities. Her biggest case, her pinnacle, was behind her. 3 years earlier, she had led an investigation that took down a circuit judge in the largest judicial bribery scandal in Florida history. She'd caught the judge in bed with a crime syndicate that was skimming millions from an Indian casino. The criminals were now locked away in federal prisons with years to serve. The case was sensational. For a brief period of time, gave BJC its finest hour. Most of her colleagues quickly parlayed the success into better jobs. The legislature, however, showed its gratitude with another round of budget cuts. Her pinnacle had cost her dearly. She had been severely injured in a staged auto accident near the casino. She spent weeks in a hospital and months in physical therapy. Her injuries had healed, the aches and stiffness were still there. Hugo Hatch, her friend, colleague, and passenger, had been killed at the scene. His widow filed a wrongful death suit, and Lacey pursued her own case for damages. The litigation looked promising. A nice settlement was all but guaranteed, but it was dragging on, as do most civil lawsuits. She found it impossible not to think about the settlement. A pile of money was almost on the table, funds that were being aggregated by the government forfeiture of dirty assets. But the issues, both criminal and civil, were complicated. There was no shortage of aggrieved people and their hungry lawyers clamoring for the cash. Her case was not yet set for trial, and she had been assured from the beginning that it would never happen. Her lawyer was confident the defendants were horrified at the prospect of facing a jury and trying to explain away the intricate planning of a deliberate crash that killed Hugo and injured her. Settlement negotiations should commence any day now, and the opening round would be in excess of seven figures. Turning 40 might be traumatic, but doing so with a fortified bank account would take some of the sting out of it. She had a decent salary, some money inherited from her mother, no debts, and plenty of savings. The settlement would push her over the edge and allow her to walk away, to where, she wasn't sure. But it was certainly fun to think about. Her days at BJC were numbered, and that in itself made her smile. It was almost time for a new career, and the fact that she didn't have a clue as to where she might go was actually exhilarating. In the meantime, though, she had a few files to close, a few judges to investigate. Normally, she began each day with a pep talk to force herself back to the office, but not today. She was intrigued by Jerry Crosby and her fantastic story about a murderous